House Republicans recently outlined a plan for the next federal budget, and there are some in the party that say that plan doesn't adequately fund the Pentagon and national security. President Obama has asked for $38 billion more in his budget plans. Where do you come down on that question of spending for defense?
You know, I think the most important thing that we spend money on is national defense. I think it's a priority. And when I look at federal spending, my eye always prioritizes what we can do to defend the country. That being said, not every dollar spent is wisely spent, and so I'm an advocate of actually auditing the Pentagon and making sure that the money is well spent. I think you have to look at it in context. We've doubled the amount that we spent in the Pentagon over the last 10 years. We spend more than the next 14 countries combined. And so I think there is room for finding some savings in the Pentagon and getting the money better spent. I've introduced this week a bill called the Military Sequester Flexibility Act. What that allows the Pentagon to do is to take about $50 billion, about 10% of their budget, and move it around to avoid any of the negative effects of the sequester. Part of the problem with the sequester is it's caused the defense or the Pentagon to have to cut every department the same percentage, whereas if you were doing this in a rational way, there may be some departments you might want to zero out completely, and there might be other departments you might need to increase. And so really, I think the Pentagon does need more flexibility, and that's what my Military Sequester Flexibility Act will do.
Now, last fall, you talked about the U.S. needing to be more realistic in its approach worldwide, meaning not necessarily intervening as often as we have. There's an argument that because the U.S. was withdrawing from Iraq and didn't intervene further in Syria, that we now have ISIS. We have the so-called Islamic State. Has that group's rise changed the way you view U.S. intervention in the world?
I think there's the opposite argument, actually. I think Hillary's war in Libya has led to chaos, the rise of radical Islam, and actually more of a threat to America now than before Hillary's war in Libya. I think the war in Syria, quite a bit of arms were put into that war, into the civil war. 600 tons worth of weapons were put in 2013 alone. Much of these were from the U.S. Much of this was from Saudi Arabia. Much of this was from Qatar. But I think the argument can be made that all of that weaponry, much of it wound up in the hands of ISIS, and that also by us participating and trying to degrade Assad, that we actually allowed ISIS to inadvertently to grow and allowed them a safe haven. So I think you can argue that the intervention in Libya and in Syria has been deleterious and actually has made our problem worse. I opposed also the bombing of Assad when the president wanted to bomb Assad as well. But I find it very difficult for people to argue that had we bombed Assad, that ISIS wouldn't be larger, stronger, and more of a problem. In fact, I think ISIS would be in Damascus now had we bombed Assad.
When you campaigned in the most recent election cycle for Scott Brown in the U.S. Senate race here in New Hampshire and in other parts of the country, you talked about reaching out to a group you called Leave Me the Hell Alone Voters. There are people who have very complex feelings about government. They may be opposed to government surveillance programs, but they might also want an increase in student aid, student loans. Does everyone who potentially thinks of him or herself as a leave me the hell alone voter actually want government to leave them the hell alone?
I think a plurality of Americans are no longer Republican or Democrat. Your statistics up here show a large amount of people who actually are independents. And you're right, people have a mixture of views. Many people are more fiscally conservative than President Obama, but are more socially moderate or liberal than many Republicans. So there are a mixture of ideas, and nobody's exactly the same as others. I say, look, my wife and I don't agree on every issue. You know, many Republicans don't agree. So there is a variety of issues. You know, I think, for example, with privacy, you're right. Most students do want some privacy, and they don't want the government looking at their phone records, but they also are concerned about tuition. I'm concerned about tuition as well, and I have a plan basically to allow students to deduct the principal and the interest and to deduct it over a lifetime and to raise the caps for students. So we have concern, same as maybe some on the Democrat side do. We just have concern that we want to make it the way we fix the problem, not just to be, hey, Santa Claus is in town and pass out a bunch of money we don't have or that we have to borrow from China. We want to make the program such that it would be based on work and based on allowing people to deduct over their working career the expense of college.
one of the obstacles to an approach to try and expand the base of a party is that you would have to potentially go through the primary process. The primary voters are not necessarily representative of the mainstream. So how do you try to make the argument that you can reach out to these voters while still hanging on to a more traditional conservative voter who's going to be part of the primary process?
Well, I think for me, it's actually pretty easy because I'm very, very fiscally conservative. If you look on any conservative scorecard in Washington, I'll be one of the most conservative. But if you also look in Washington on liberty issues that I think have the ability to reach out, you'll find that I'm very commonly working with Democrats on liberty issues. But none of these make me any less conservative. The idea of whether or not somebody who has a teenager is caught with marijuana or caught selling marijuana would get 55 years in prison, I think you'll find many Christian evangelical conservatives who think that's ridiculous as well. So some of these issues do cut across lines in interesting ways, but I think what you'll find is that I think that my conservative message will resonate with the base, and I've not let up on it one bit, but I think you'll find that the liberty message has the ability to reach out to new constituencies such as African American, Hispanic, people who live in poverty, that my message of reducing taxes dramatically for areas of poverty and high unemployment is going to and will resonate and has resonated in places as far-flung as Chicago and Detroit.
Is that how you can overcome a political dynamic which where candidates such as, say, Scott Walker or Jeb Bush, who have been here less often than you have, are being talked about as front runners, whereas you've been here quite more often and maybe aren't getting the attention that those candidates are getting?
No, we think we are getting plenty of attention, and some of the numbers at this point still are name recognition. You know, there's probably not one person in the United States who doesn't know the name Bush, but there still are a few that haven't quite heard all they need to know about me, and they'll find out that over time. But we feel very comfortably positioned in national polls, scoring solidly in the first tier in the early primary states, and it's a position from which, should we get involved, we think we can win.
Should you get involved, you said you might hope to make a final decision on whether to run for president in the spring. And we are talking on the first day of spring. When might we expect an announcement?
Very soon.